Blog Talk Radio.
Gets here just in time for his own squeak. Good evening and welcome to Eerie House Radio. I'm Dale Kay from Spook Show. I am joined by
Dave Binkley from Weirdness, Really Bad Movie, and Spaceship One. And let me tell you something, Dale. I have done unearthed another document and have finally finished transcribing for the latest episode of Ugg the Caveman.
Oh, which, so we're going to get a visit from Ugg today?
We're going to get a visit from Ugg tonight after the story. So a little initiative to hang around for a little bit to find out what happens, what Ugg is up to this week.
Yes, and quite a wait you'll have, because we got a bit of a lengthy tale for you tonight in a billion segments, which I don't see, but I'm sure they'll appear somewhere.
There should be five.
Holy crap.
There's five of them. Yes.
Five, count them, five segments. So a full two-hour show tonight. Our apologies to our partner, Gar, who will be starting at 8 o'clock on the Twitches. But,
I talked to him this morning while breakfasting, and he said, it's okay, because I apologized to him that we're having to bleed over. He said, but, hey, I'll be there just as soon as we're done with we wrap up. I'll be right over to Horrible Horror, starring Gar the Girl.
Yes. But until then, we do have a wonderful tale, another curse.
Yes.
We've been cursed this weekend. Now, where's CW, man? The Girl of Mystery.
I know. The Girl of Mystery is cursing us by not being here once again. And she's probably cursed with that nasty four-letter word, work.
Yes, that's what we suspect. I hope all is well, and lots of old-time radio to y'all. It's Cape Cod Mystery Theater tonight. Our second offering, I believe, from this source.
Yes, the first time we did it was on Killer Radio Night, where the caller on line one, where a crazy caller called into the studio, eventually came in and killed the radio host. That's killer radio, man.
Yikes.
This is not such a thing. This is a kind of a mystery. Well, it isn't kind of. This is a mystery to go along with the curse. But it's Inspector or Captain Underhill. He's a retired police captain. And his associate friend is a doctor. And, a retired policeman and doctor kind of sounds like a Sherlock Holmes and Watson. And sort of is. But it's a fun, really cool story. There were several of these, and this and Uriah Peller are probably my two favorite stories coming from Captain Waverly Underhill.
Yeah, and a bad curse for the whale to not have his tooth, I suppose, too.
Yep, that'll get explained in the story as well. These come to us from the Cape Cod area. And everything that seems to be in these wrap around that area. They were aired on local PBS stations down over in the New England area. But it's a foggy night and time for a good mystery is how they always like to start off their shows.
And whale's tooth, huh? Can you imagine being a whale's dentist?
Man, I don't think you'd afford gold to fill in those cavities. I'm telling you.
Yeah, nah. Just gonna use plastic there.
I heard Jimmy Hoffa was in one of those. I understand Jimmy Hoffa was put into one of those cavities.
Yeah,
and then covered up.
He's everywhere. Bits of him. Man, when they don't ever find you, you know the mafia was mad at you.
Yeah, yep.
Or the government, one of the two.
Yep, nothing but rumors, that's for sure. There's a man who ended up being cursed.
There you go.
You know, we were talking, we've been talking before. I think we've talked about Tony Blake. Was that his name, Tony Blake? I remember he did a Hoffa movie, a made-for-TV movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and his son turned around and also became head of the I don't know if he's still head of the union, but his son did become head of the union for some time as well.
Yeah. That was an interesting time in history in our life, gang.
It was all the way around, yeah.
Some rough and tumble stuff, but anywho, we got a rough and tumble story for you. Curse of the Whale's Tooth from Cape Cod Mystery Theater.
Yes.
And this was an interesting, PBS offering, right, Dave?
NPR, yeah.
Or NPR, sorry about that. National Public Radio, just offering homage to the old radio programs. And
yep, exactly.
Much like yesterday, we're going to make up a date, and we dare you to challenge us.
Well, we can come up with a definite year.
At least we can get a rough estimate then, yeah.
Yeah, so the definite year is that this episode of Cape Cod Mystery Theater comes to us from 1994.
Ooh.
First mate reporting, sir.
Bad,
sir. We're hard aground.
That's like that cursed light,
sir. We could light her up, pull her off.
It's no use. The wind is out of the east. Set the candle in the moving diamond.
What shall we do, sir?
Tell the crew. Gather everyone half. We'll load up to make way out the savage side.
But, sir! It is, sir! It'll be suicide!
It'll be suicide if we don't. We must get off. If we stay aboard, we'll perish for certain. Inform Mr. Sweeney we're abandoning ship. Tell him to collect his people and follow orders from the crew.
He won't mind leaving these animals!
His animals be damned! It will be God's own miracle if we can save ourselves. Now go and make preparations. We must get out before she starts breaking up.
Aye, aye, sir!
Listen to that. The devil's own chorus calling us all. As sure as this night is long, we're coming. By morning, we'll be lucky if a single one of us is left alive. All on account of that light, that God-cursed light!
It's a foggy night on Old Cape Cod. A perfect night for a mystery. Tonight, Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater presents a gothic tale of mystery and suspense in a story entitled The Curse of the Whale's Tooth. Tonight, we witness the fulfillment of an ancient family curse, a curse spawned by greed and carried forward death by death, generation by generation, until it comes to reside most frighteningly in the present. A curse whose talisman is an unusual piece of scrimshaw, whose focus is a terrified young woman, and whose manifestation comes in the shape of a creature, part real and part ephemeral, whose prowling in the night foretells that the curse is no longer dormant. Another death is about to take place.
Astonishing!
That's really the only way to describe it. A strange and interlocking chronology of events dating back to the whaling days of New Bedford. It continues as one of the most remarkable cases Captain Underhill has ever been associated with. I'm speaking, of course, of Captain Waverly Underhill, the ex-police captain, whose retirement did not signal an end to his career of solving crimes. Captain Underhill likes to represent himself as a basket case of old age and senility. A basket case, indeed. A basket full of brains is what he is. As for me, I'm Alexander Schofield, a not-quite-retired family physician. My own involvement in the case began on the day I decided to pay a visit, unannounced, on my friend at his home in Hyannisport. My own arrival was preceded by another unexpected visitor, whose purpose in looking up Captain Underhill was more serious than my own.
Excuse me, I'm looking for Captain Waverly Underhill's house.
You've got the wrong one. This is number 18. You want number 16.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. These bungalows all look alike. I get confused myself sometimes. Are you looking for Underhill?
Yes, I am.
Who sent you?
Mrs. Theodora Langhorne. She recommended him very highly. Is he at home, do you know?
Right at the moment, he's not. What did you want to see him about?
Well, it's a professional matter.
Whose profession? Yours or his?
Well, his, actually.
Are you in some kind of trouble?
Well, that's something I would rather discuss with him.
Hmm. Well, go ahead. I'm Underhill.
You are? But I thought you just said
Don't worry. I may be senile, but I'm not that senile. My front porch just got painted. I'm using this one till it dries.
Where are the people who live here?
Dead. Or on vacation. When you live in a retirement village, you can never be sure. Now, what did you want to see me about, Mr.,
Penniman. Roger Penniman.
Oh, I see. That explains a lot. And tell you what, Professor Penniman, suppose we adjourn to my house. I'll fix us both some iced tea, and you can tell me about it. If you want lemon or mint, I have both.
Oh, no, this is fine.
Oh, damnation!
Excuse me a moment. I think we have another visitor.
Hello, Alex. Having trouble?
Waverly, I'm sorry. I didn't see the sign, and I didn't realize the porch was wet until it was too late.
That is quite the fancy footwork. Reminds me of an Arthur Murray dance chart. What were you doing, the rumba?
I'm sorry I made such a mess of it.
Never mind that. Come on into the kitchen. We have a guest.
Oh, well, I don't mean to intrude.
You won't be. Professor Penniman, I'd like you to meet my friend and physician, Dr. Alexander Schofield.
How do you do?
Dr. Schofield is what is known as a reverse hypochondriac. He imagines that everyone else is sick.
Oh, Waverly, please. Professor Penniman, how do you do?
Have a seat, Alex. Professor Penniman was just about to tell me about the animal problem he's been having recently. Professor, I'll appreciate it if you will also take my friend into your confidence.
You seem to know quite a lot about it already.
Only what I've read in the newspaper, which likely has very little to do with what really happened. I'll be much more interested to hear your account, complete and from the beginning, please. That is, if you'd like me to help you.
To understand it all, you'll have to go back nearly 100 years to the city of New Bedford, to a man named Jacob Penniman, who was my great-grandfather. Jacob Penniman was captain and part owner of a whaling ship that hunted in the waters off Nova Scotia and Greenland. Profits from these commercial expeditions were always handsome, largely because of the methods employed by my great-grandfather to hunt the whales. Methods that ensured that the hold of the ship was never less than completely full each time it returned to harbor. And yet, they were methods that were considered cruel and ruthless, even in those times, even among the whalers themselves. One of his favorite techniques, whenever he happened upon a mother whale and calf, was to kill the calf first, and then leisurely slaughter the mother, knowing full well she would never abandon her young. In a sense, it was this sort of practice that was also the reason that a tooth from one of these slaughtered baby whales came to be transformed into a most unusual piece of scrimshaw. There will be much to say about this later, but for now I will simply describe it. A small, slightly curving piece of whale bone, perhaps half again as large as a rabbit's foot. The tooth was not adorned with the usual familiar scenes of a square rigger riding the waves or a harpoon boat pulled along in a Nantucket sleigh ride. Instead, there was a strange collaboration of astrological symbols. A crescent moon with a dark face barely visible. A cattle of stars with an unknown constellation hovering above. And a strange swirling spiral like the shape of a hurricane. Jacob Penniman acquired this unique piece of scrimshaw from a sailor who carved it on board ship during one of the voyages, and my great-grandfather took to carrying it with him always as a talisman of good fortune. And good fortune it seemed to bring, at least financially. Jacob Penniman might easily have been the role model for Melville's Captain Ahab, except there was no white whale he chased after. The only Leviathan Jacob Penniman pursued was the Leviathan of his own greed. Like many other whaling captains of his time, Jacob Penniman supplemented his income by engaging in smuggling. Little contraband on board ship helped ensure that the success or failure of each voyage was not solely dependent upon the profits from the whale oil. Gradually, as he became more prosperous, he took to the sea less often. He became more of a financier of whaling ventures. He also took, for the first time, a wife. Her name was Hester Penniman, and she was half her husband's age. Together, they managed to produce a son they called Nathan. Within a year, however, the marriage had dissolved into hatred. Unfortunately for Hester Penniman, the concept of mental cruelty was not so well established in those days. Unable to obtain a divorce and being unsuccessful at convincing the pillars of New Bedford society, who refused to believe that the respectable Jacob Penniman could possibly be guilty of mistreating his wife, Hester Penniman was finally left with no alternative but to take her baby and flee. Jacob Penniman, of course, did the only dignified thing. He publicly renounced his wife and proclaimed, in so many words, that he would no longer bestow the beneficence of his generosity upon so unworthy and ungrateful a woman. Soon afterwards, however, in the face of opposition from certain members of the clergy, who felt that perhaps it was he and not she who was in the wrong, Jacob Penniman scornfully removed himself and his money from New Bedford and relocated upon the outer reaches of Cape Cod. There, he built what remains today the most lavish and ornate example of a sea captain's house ever constructed along the eastern seaboard. Resplendent with columns and scrollwork and gables and dormers, the house Jacob Penniman built was located 100 yards inland, within sight and sound of the ocean, and looking eastward across a high escarpment of sandy cliffs. Set within 10,000 acres of privately owned land, the only way into the property was along a winding sand driveway that stretched for several miles before allowing a visitor his first glimpse of the solitary house. Perched on his promontory, surrounded by a sea of seagrass, and made all the more mysterious by the twin jawbones of a sperm whale that framed a prayerful arch above the pathway that a buggy must pass under to reach the house. There, Jacob Penniman chose to live, alone, with little contact with the outside world, save for the goods he had delivered, and a cleaning woman named Esmalina Saffron, who came once a week. It is a testament to the depravity of his own soul that Jacob Penniman, out of boredom and evil-minded malice, could turn about and prey upon the same men whose livelihood he had once shared. During the height of the gale season, when deadly northeasters came sweeping in from across the Grand Banks, on moonless nights or on nights when the clouds were so thick they shut out every ray of moonlight, Jacob Penniman would venture out with a lantern and a pole. There, upon the cliff, he would set the lantern on the pole and point the pole into the air as a signal light, proclaiming to any passing ship a safe harbor for the night. Then, secure in the knowledge that he had done all that he could, he would return to his house and retire for the evening, allowing the elements and chance and his shining false beacon to conspire together to lure ships to their doom. Such was the fate of the cargo ship Lucinda, bound from Liverpool en route to New York, which saw the beacon that stormy night and, mistaking it for a refuge, steered directly onto the shoal. In the morning, when the storm had passed, and the only evidence of its ever having been was the pounding of the surf, Jacob Penniman awoke from an untroubled sleep, got dressed, and walked out to the cliffside to see what the storm had brought. His first sight was of the ship itself, 300 yards out, lying swamped and broken upon her side. Looking down, he saw the bodies of the men and women on the beach, some who had drowned, others who had died from the battering of the waves. His sharp eye was attracted to a large, unidentifiable shape rolling in the breakers. Puzzled, he moved over to the path that led down to the beach and followed it down until he was standing at the edge of the waves, still trying to make out what it was. It appeared to be the carcass of an animal. A whale, he thought. At least the color and thickness of the hide made it appear so. Here and there were places where chunks of flesh were torn away by the sharks that had already been to work. Finally, a larger wave came and rolled the animal over, and he saw for the first time what it was. An elephant. He stood there, trying to comprehend the impossibility of what he was seeing, until gradually it dawned on him what the ship had been carrying when she went aground. A circus. A European circus bound from England on its way to a tour of America. The thought struck him as funny. Indescribably funny. He began to laugh. And his laughter rose and blended with the raucous cries of the seagulls. His laughter continued to grow until it was joined by another sound. A low, throated growl that came from directly behind him. He turned to look, and his laughter was transformed into a scream that barely escaped his lips before the lion leapt forward and struck him down with a single swipe of its paw. No one could say that justice had not been served. Jacob Penniman's death came about as a direct result of his own wickedness. His corpse, when it was finally discovered in the underbrush where the lion had dragged it, was so badly mutilated it was beyond recognition. However, there was no doubting it was him. In the pocket of his torn trousers was found the object he had carried with him every day without fail, the whale's tooth pendant.
That's part one of five of our show tonight. Curse of the Whale.
Action right from the beginning. Right from the beginning.
Yeah, this one hit the ground running.
Yeah. Interesting, interesting show. Yep. But wait, the curse is just beginning.
Yes.
The story of the curse, anyway, yes.
Rebel, frebel, rebel, snarl.
You know, we talked last week, Dale, when CW was here, about whether we believed in luck or not. Do you believe in curses?
Nah, I'm a skeptic.
I am as well, yeah.
I think sometimes we create our own curses. Just as you can create your own good luck, you can create your own bad luck,
yes.
Too.
True.
I believe.
Yes,
my thing.
You know, and sometimes there are other scientific answers for what happens in a curse, like when you get to the mm-hmm. sometimes because the dust or the odors or the things like that when they open up a particular tomb, which is like the curse you mostly think of, Egyptian curses, that kind of thing. But it could be the odors as much as anything else, and. Unless you're walking in a hazmat suit, which nobody did, you're susceptible to all kinds of things that have been trapped for thousands of years in many cases, you know?
Yeah, something that maybe there's no need to be a cure for, and so there isn't. That's why they made the movie, Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. But there you go.
There you go. Yeah.
I wouldn't be probing around corpse stuff. Don't be touching that stuff, man.
I myself also am extremely, you know, the curse of the Hope Diamond and all these different things that the whoever owns this shall die a horrible death or whatever, you know, come on.
Yeah. Well, like, wasn't there supposedly a curse on King Tut's tomb, no? And I think some people died, but there were actual logical explanations as to why they died.
Let me see. Would they dig up that in about 1928, something like that?
Yeah, late 20s, probably.
Yeah. So here we are. You know, this proves the curse. Every adult that was on that expedition is dead. That proves the curse, right?
Yeah, okay, sure. Except for that small matter of it being 1,000 years ago. Well, I'm exaggerating, but you guys get the point. So sometimes we'll try to use that logic, and it's, yeah, okay, whatever.
Nope. Yeah.
Nope, they're still dead.
They're still dead, yes.
Yeah,
I tell that to Karloff, yeah.
General, yeah. Hell no. Imhotep. I like the Brendan Fraser Mummy movies. Those were good. They were fun.
I thought they were fun, and they had a tremendous amount of action to them as well. So, yes.
Yeah, and the CGI was not bad.
Yeah, CGI was, and that was not, I wouldn't say in its infancy, but it was pretty, you know, it was very young in a lot of CGI.
Yep.
You know what the first movie that really used CGI in?
Lost World? Or, I mean,
Jurassic Park.
Yeah,
Jurassic Park. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess because there were, like, stop-motion guys who were there who kind of were really brought on to do all all the other stuff. And the guy came in and showed them video of CGI. And I guess while it was going on, they kind of looked at each other and said, we're out of a job. But Steven Spielberg still had a lot of live action type stuff and large models and things like that. And it wasn't just CGI.
Well, a lot of the CGI techs will tell you, though, that they owe their careers and all that stuff to the Willis O'Briens, to the Ray Harryhausens who did the animations. I think that helped them model how the programs work. That would be my guess.
I would say you're right with that. Yeah.
That would be my guess because I have heard that many of the CGI people are like, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing without, you know, like I said, O'Brien, Harryhausen, Jim Danforth, my favorites.
Well, because they made that kind of effect acceptable.
Yes.
And by making it acceptable, this is the next generation of stop action animation is the CGI. It's the next step in that.
Yeah, I resisted at first, but, you know, as I see them apply it, and a lot of times, as in Jurassic Park, they mixed it with practical effects too, which which helps the realism. But we got a real good radio story, don't we?
We do. I'm just going to add one more thing about CGI. If it weren't for CGI, an amazing animator, we would never have Spaceship One and some of the really neat things that we've done with that.
And that in and of itself is reason enough to pay homage.
There you go.
Pay homage as we now go to part two of Curse of the Whale's Tooth. The Tooth.
This, of course, was the beginning of the curse. The whale's tooth pendant was handed down to Jacob Penniman's son, Nathan, who kept it until the age of 29, when he was crushed to death in a bizarre industrial accident.
The family Nathan Penniman left behind included my father, Philip Penniman, who became the next owner of the heirloom.
Was your father aware of the risk involved in owning it?
No. In fact, up to then, no one had even considered the possibility of there being any sort of bad luck associated with it. The notion was first put forward by a magazine writer who, while doing a story on Scrimshaw, and after seeing the piece my father owned and listening to the story behind it, suggested, obviously as a way to make his article more interesting, that there might be a curse connected with it. 3 weeks after the article appeared, my father was transferred to Pearl Harbor, where he became one of the earliest American casualties of the Second World War. When his personal effects were sent home, it was discovered he had had the whale's tooth with him when he died. The same writer wrote another article, and it was from then on that the popular notion of a family curse took firm hold.
And now the Scrimshaw has passed to you?
Actually, no. Upon my father's death, the keepsake passed to my older brother, Remington Penniman.
And where is he?
He and his wife were both drowned 14 years ago when their car slid off an icy bridge into a river.
I see. Another example of the curse.
The heirloom now belongs to Nora Penniman, their only child. When my brother and his wife were killed, my wife and I took Nora and raised her as our own. As we have had no children of our own, Nora has always been very important to us. The Scrimshaw was kept for her in a safety deposit box until she reached the age of 18.
How old is she now?
At 19. She asked me for it. I felt I had no choice but to give it to her.
But you don't feel good about it?
Well, no, naturally. How can I? Especially in light of what you have recently read about in the newspaper.
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with...
That's all right, Alex. I'd like to hear Professor Penniman tell us his own account of what happened.
The first time was 5 nights ago. Nora was up in her room. Priscilla and I had just finished watching the 11 o'clock news and we were getting ready to go to bed. We have an old dog, a mastiff named Gladiator. He was outside barking. Barking quite emphatically about something.
Roger, go and see what's bothering Gladiator.
It's nothing. Probably just the moon coming up over the ocean. He's done it before.
Well, whatever it is, I think you should go and see.
Oh, all right. Gladiator is not accustomed to barking at every little noise in the night. Naturally, I wanted to find out what it was that was disturbing him. I went out into the kitchen. I tried switching on the outside light, but I forgot the bulb needed replacing. I picked up the flashlight off the windowsill, and I went outside.
Gladiator? What's the matter, boy?
He was barking in the direction of the tool shed. His hackles were raised. Even as I spoke to him, his attention remained riveted on the shed.
What's the matter, boy? What is it?
I shone the light in the direction of the shed. There was nothing visible that appeared out of the ordinary. Then, as I moved the light a little more to the right, the beam of the flashlight penetrated through the hedgerow at the edge of the yard. And I caught the reflection of its eyes. It appeared to be a large feline animal crouching down, poised as if to leap. Oh, my God! My God!
Roger? What is it?
Get inside! Hurry, quickly! Get inside!
I will admit I was a little startled when I saw the thing, and as I think anyone would be. I backed up quickly, which caused the thing, whatever it was, to suddenly move away. And so that was all the time I had to form any kind of opinion about what it was.
What opinion did you arrive at?
I don't know. I mean, how could I? I was baffled. I had never before seen or encountered anything like it.
And so what did you do?
Well, of course, we immediately closed and locked all of the windows and doors on the ground floor. I called the National Seashore people and finally got hold of one of their rangers, Mr. Wendell Johnson. Quite naturally, he was skeptical at first, but I finally persuaded him to come out. He arrived in half an hour, excited and no longer skeptical. He had seen the beast himself as he drove in. It had darted in front of his truck. He had had to swerve to avoid hitting it. Of course, there was nothing we could do about the problem right then. We discussed what we had both seen. We talked about what should be done. He promised to take the matter up with the proper state officials first thing in the morning, and so we left it at that. All this I'm sure you have read about in the newspaper. They were quite accurate in reporting what I had seen and what the park ranger had seen. What they did not report, and what I have not told anyone else up to now, is that I saw the creature a second time.
Oh? When was that?
Later that same night. After the park ranger left, Priscilla and I stayed up. Finally, she went to bed, but I couldn't sleep. I was still agitated about what had happened. I put on my robe and I went on up to the roof. The sky was clear. Thin ice clouds were moving in from the west. There was a faint corona around the moon. I was standing at the railing, looking down at the path of moonlight that came across the water, when suddenly I saw it. Out in the dunes, a darker shape moving against the darkness. My eyes followed it as it raced up the incline of one of the dunes. As the creature crested the hill, I saw its silhouette for a moment in the moonlight across the water. It was definitely the shape of a male African lion. So I thought. Of course, there was no opportunity for a second look. Frankly, if you ask me now, I could not say with absolute conviction that I did see it, that I did not somehow imagine it, owing to lack of sleep and feeling overwrought, which is why up to now I have chosen not to mention it to anyone. And yet, at the time, it seemed quite real, but also not there, if you know what I mean.
I know what he's saying, Waverly. It's quite true. Medically speaking, it is an easy thing for the mind to play tricks, especially late at night, especially when there had been a shock to the nervous system. Though I'm not suggesting that what Professor Penniman saw was in any way a delusion.
Yes, thank you, Alex. Tell me, Professor, were these sightings only that, or was there more than the visual aspect involved?
You're referring to the strange animal cries reported in the paper. Yes, we have heard them continually, off and on, since the first night. They always occur at night. It is a sound like you would expect a large cat to make, but there is an eeriness about it, an unearthly quality that I don't know how to characterize, except to say that it is quite chilling, and once you've heard it, you never quite forget it.
I see. Please go on.
Well, of course, I'm sure you read about the hunt that took place. It was covered in the media in some detail.
I would still like to hear your version.
Well, as you may know, our property is the largest private in-holding within the National Seashore. It was decided by park officials, with permission from state and federal authorities, that they would attempt to run the animal to bay using hounds. You see, they had come to the conclusion that the animal was possibly an eastern mountain lion. Of course, mountain lions were once native to this area, but that was many years ago. Even so, it was felt that there still existed enough habitat and food supply of deer and so forth to support a small population of this species. The hunt was planned for midnight of the second day. By now, news of what had happened had unavoidably spread to the public, so that when the van pulled up with the hounds, it was accompanied by several other cars full of reporters. The television crew had come to film the beginning of the hunt. I had mixed feelings about the publicity this would bring, but there did not seem to be anything I could do about it. Cat was already out of the bag, so to speak. The rear of the van was opened, and the dogs were let out. Approximately half a dozen hounds, each in a separate leash. The dogs were alert and excited. They seemed to know that some game was afoot, but just what particular game it was going to be, they had yet to be told. The reporters would have had us standing around forever. I was anxious to get started, and so were the others. The handler took the dogs one by one over to the spot where I was sure the beast had lain. After 24 hours, I assumed whatever scent still remained would be extremely faint, but not so faint that these amazing hounds were not able to pick it up. In a very short while, we were off. The group consisted of myself carrying a 12-gauge shotgun, Wendell Johnson, armed with a service revolver, the handler carrying a pistol and holster, and the state biologist carrying a rifle equipped to fire tranquilizing darts. The conditions that night as we trudged along silently behind the rapidly working dogs were less than ideal. Not because of the moon, which was bright enough that it might have helped, nor the fact that there was no wind, which only would have disturbed the scent. The problem was the fog. A heavy fog had rolled in off the ocean and taken refuge behind every dune. It lay especially thick in all of the kettle-like depressions. The effect was quite unnerving. As the trail led upwards to the crest of a dune, we would emerge out of these mists into the clear, crisp night air. It was going back down that was the worst. It was like going underwater, descending into a suffocating, dense packet of water vapor, where the shapes of things could only be made out at close range, and where the beams of our flashlights were transformed into magical wands of light. The thought of actually cornering the beast under these conditions was terrifying. I thought several times of suggesting we call it off, but no one else seemed to be interested in doing anything of the kind, so I said nothing. We followed the trail for a good distance, the hounds keeping up a steady working pace. We emerged one last time into the night air and then began another agonizing descent into the murky abstract, where the only recognizable feature in the ghostly landscape was the full moon hanging above us like an ineffectual light bulb. We were working our way down the backside of a dune when I noticed that the hound's barking had suddenly changed. It was now almost feverish with excitement. I assumed this meant we were closing the gap. There was no longer any need for silence. We moved ahead cautiously, talking back and forth, making sure at all times we knew exactly where the other person was. At the bottom of the basin, the trail led directly toward a dense thicket of alder bushes. The behavior of the hounds left no question that the animal was somewhere within. With all of us stationed at points all around the thicket, and with a biologist with a tranquilizing gun positioned in the most likely spot where the creature would emerge, the hounds were let loose from their restraints. They charged violently into the underbrush. At any moment, I expected a confrontation between the hounds and the creature, or the creature and one of us. But instead, after a few minutes, the hounds stopped barking. We were all of us amazed. There was no question in our minds that the hounds had followed the scent, that the scent had led us to this spot, and that the excited barking of the hounds indicated that the animal was very near. And yet there was nothing. The creature had disappeared, completely vanished, as if the earth had somehow opened up and swallowed it.
You searched the thicket?
We did, but there was nothing. No trace.
What about tracks?
Well, we looked for tracks, naturally. And we found some, but unfortunately none of them were very distinct. As you would expect, sandy soil is not the best terrain for preserving animal tracks.
I see. Is there any more information you have to tell us?
That pretty much sums up everything that has happened up to now.
Then let me see if I understand the implication. So far, in addition to hearing the animal at night, there have been three confirmed sightings, twice by you and once by the park ranger. There's also been an unsuccessful attempt to run the animal to bay with hounds, this by the Park Service, who believe the animal could be an eastern mountain lion. From what you've told us, I assume that among the many possibilities, there is one the media has not yet picked up on, a possibility connected to the Penniman curse, which suggests that the curse is no longer dormant and that Nora's life may now be in jeopardy.
Well, I'm not saying that's true. That's not my contention.
The Penniman estate is still a private inholding inside the park?
Well, that's right.
What happens if you sell?
If we sell? Well, if we sell, it would then be included as part of the National Seashore. However, as long as it stays within the family, it can remain in private hands. If you are thinking the Park Service is trying to drive us out, force us to sell.
If you do sell the property, who benefits?
What do you mean?
Who gets the money?
Well, me, I suppose. Although a small share would pass to the niece of my sister-in-law who drowned in the car accident. Once again, if you're thinking this is some sort of attempt to frighten us off the land...
Do you live on the property year-round?
Oh, not year-round, no. Summers, of course. During the academic year, I stay in her apartment in Cambridge. Both Priscilla and Nora are down here much more often than I.
Do you have a groundskeeper?
We have a gardener.
Hmm. Any other hired help?
No, my wife does all the house cleaning herself.
I see. Is there anyone else? Anyone who has unrestricted access to your property?
I don't think so. Of course, with 10,000 acres, almost anyone could hike in and we'd never be aware of it. Wait a minute. I just thought of someone. A former student of mine. An aspiring writer. He was looking for a remote place to spend the summer and do some writing. Several months ago, I gave him permission to use an old abandoned hunting shack on our property. He may be there now. I hadn't even thought of him until you brought it up.
All right, Professor. All right. I'll look into this if you'd like.
Oh, excellent. I was hoping you would agree. Theodora Langhorne had high praise for your abilities and your discretion.
I promise to do what I can and to do it quietly. In the meantime, I suggest you return the whale's tooth to the safety deposit box.
I'm afraid it's too late. I've already given it to her.
Is it too late?
Captain Underhill, I don't know if you have ever had to cope with raising a teenage daughter, but I can assure you Nora is quite typical. In other words, she listens continually to loud music, she is obsessive about her appearance, and she is very headstrong. Extremely headstrong.
That guy sounds like he really
has to
tell
the Waverly, this sounds like quite a remarkable case.
Yes, it does.
I take it you don't believe this business about a family curse.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
Your questions seem to imply that you think someone is behind all this.
That's just my training. I can't help but look for ulterior human motives behind even the most supernatural of events.
Well, then, have you considered that Roger Penniman may be making this all up as a publicity stunt to draw attention to himself?
The park ranger didn't make it up. The hounds who followed the scent didn't make it up. No, I don't believe Roger Penniman is looking for attention. In fact, I'm quite sure that's something he wants to avoid. Otherwise, he wouldn't have come to me. There is something we should keep in mind about Professor Penniman. He teaches at a prestigious college. I suspect, considering his age, that he may be in line to become head of his department. Having to go on record as publicly stating you have seen a monster prowling around your property is not likely to improve his chances. In fact, it might be just enough to dissuade a conservative faculty committee from voting for him.
Well, then you think that...
I think his concern about his daughter is genuine. But I think he is also aware of his own desire to protect his reputation.
Waverly, you don't suppose this could be the reason...
Yes. Yes, I do. Which is why I think one of the first things we should do is go pay a visit on the young writer in the woods.
Guy sounds like he really needs to use the restroom.
He's just an old guy, Dale. Just an old guy. We will be there soon enough, and we'll sound like him, too.
Yeah, I'm already there, my man. I'm already there.
You got to wait 2 years. I got to wait a year and 2 months, and I'm out of here, you know?
Yeah. Luckily, my dad kept his voice pretty much... actually, the very end, kept his voice. So
that's good.
And he was 82 when he passed. So,
oh, bless him.
Some people hold on to their voices, and some people don't. And obviously, Captain Waverly Underhill did not. But
no,
it's also part of a ploy to make him sound old, and as he wants to be kind of seen as senile. That way it really kind of puts everything, everyone, as he's doing things and asking questions, kind of puts him at ease, thinking he's just a senile old guy.
Yeah.
I still recommend more fiber. I think I still think he needs a little more fiber. That's just my thinking on it. That's all I got to say about that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the biggest curse of all time, Father Time.
Yes, it is. And we've not found an answer to that curse yet. That's the only curse that I kind of believe in.
Yeah, and that and taxes. That's the other curse.
Well, that's true, but what are you going to do with that?
I don't want to do any time at Leavenworth. So
Wesley Snipes tried to do without it, and look what it did for him. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Him and a few guys.
I am a sovereign citizen. I will not pay taxes. Okay, we have a room and board for you.
Yeah. That or get out is always good.
Yep.
How's that sovereignty working for you now, bud?
Yeah. Find your own island, buddy. Yeah.
That's right. Find your own island. I always wanted my own island. But it would have been a naughty place.
Yeah, but it seems like too much work now, you know. Maybe when I was younger, but.
Yeah. Yeah, I get you there, but yeah, I don't have the energy for it.
Like every once in a while you see come up on the internet feed, news feeds, island for sale. I said, oh, how cool. I said, oh, look, it's got this and this. I said, man, I don't want that much work. Forget it.
Yeah. That's like, oh, farming for me. Yeah, I want to do some farming. Oh, no, I don't.
Yeah, right.
No,
you're
no,
no
I don't.
You're no Oliver Wendell Douglas, I'm telling you.
Yeah. And Mrs. K is no Zsa Zsa or Ava. Ava, Zsa Zsa, one of them.
Girls. Ava.
It was Ava, not Zsa Zsa. Zsa Zsa's a crazy
one.
Zsa Zsa
was the crazy one. Ava was the one that was a little nicer, so.
Yeah, and they're both very beautiful women, by the way.
A very beautiful woman, yes.
Yeah. Just one of them didn't have a cheap, cheesy space movie in her... on her resume.
Yeah, but she got to be in Green Acres instead. So there you go.
That's true. And one of them didn't slap a policeman. So you got
that's
the
true.
You take your pick. You pick your poison. Jeez, we turned into a crummy talk show.
Wait, it must be a good story. Fogs and good old Bob are both pretty quiet tonight. So
yeah.
Hopefully it's because it's such a good story.
Yes. We hope that we haven't shocked you too much. Well, maybe a little.
Yeah, a little.
Yeah, we're hosts. I mean, we get hosted.
Now we pretty much have the whole story of the curse. And now we see where it goes from there. We still have, what, three more parts to this? Wow.
Three parts and parts is parts, and this is part three of Curse of the Whale's Tooth from Cape Cod Mystery Theater. Goaty go!
And so began Captain Underhill's involvement in this strange case, a case that was to become even more strange and more threatening as time went on. Our first move was to drive down and check into a motel in Truro that was nearest to the Penniman property. At least one other guest was there for the same reason. We met him, a young man sent down by a Boston magazine to do a story. It was obvious when we talked that, like the others, he had not yet made the connection between the strange appearance of the creature and the curse of the whale's tooth, a connection that was bound to be made sooner or later. We drove out to visit the Penniman home and met Mrs. Penniman. Roger was not yet back, and Nora was up in her room. Priscilla Penniman greeted us with an artificial show of politeness.
Oh, yes. Won't you come in?
She remarked how pleased she was that her husband had enlisted Captain Underhill's help.
How nice that you were able to find the time to help us.
The impression was that she felt exactly the opposite. Captain Underhill asked to meet Nora.
Why not come back later, when she's in a little better mood?
The implication here was that mother and daughter had just finished having a terrific fight, and Nora could not be relied upon to be civil to strangers. On our way out, we stopped and talked to the gardener, who was raking up grass clippings in the side yard. Not a very tolerant man, a Bible-thumping extremist, whose opinion of the Pennimans had categorized them as some sort of original sinners.
Do I believe it exists? It does if God wills it.
Have you seen any evidence of it being around?
Omens.
What sort of omens?
None that you would understand. The Lord hath dominion over all creatures. It exists as he wills it, and it will cease to exist when it has served his purpose.
That purpose being?
It is not for me to divine the ways of the Lord. I will say this. They have called this curse down upon themselves. The mother is a Jezebel. The daughter a wicked harlot. A temptress of the flesh.
Why work for them?
All my work is the Lord's work.
Have you heard about the family curse? Do you believe in it?
I believe in the wrath of God. And I say this, abide not with the sinners, else you yourself become tainted.
Following our conversation with the gardener, we drove off the property and south on the Mid-Cape to the National Seashore headquarters. We found Wendell Johnson in his office. He mistook us for reporters until we set him straight. We finally managed to convince him to go over once more what had happened the night he saw the creature.
It was the damnedest thing.
He told of driving his panel truck in along the road that led into the property.
It was pretty dark to begin with. The trees along the drive had grown in close, so there wasn't much visibility on either side. The moon was only halfway up through the trees, so it wasn't doing much good. And the stand driveway was full of bumps, so the headlights, they were bouncing around a bit. When I first saw it, it was moving like a streak, right to left, directly in front of the truck.
Holy jeez!
I swerved when I thought I was going to hit it. As it was, I came close to clipping it with my left fender. Whatever it was, it was moving fast, like something bigger than it was chasing behind.
When he finished describing what he had seen, Underhill began to ask questions. Wendell Johnson became instantly more defensive, as though recalling the dubious looks he had seen on the faces of the reporters.
This wasn't a bobcat. I spent 6 years studying wolves in the wilds in Minnesota. I've seen bobcats before. Whatever this was not a bobcat.
All right. What do you think it was?
Well, let me tell you. You know, people who have never been out to these dunes before usually picture them as big piles of drifting sand. These dunes don't drift at all, except right down at the beach. Inland, you've got plenty of vegetation. There's seagrass and heath, and just mile by square mile of alder bush and scrub oak that never grows higher than your waist. But it's just impossible to walk through. I know, I've tried. It's stiff. Half an hour of walking through that stuff and it raises welts all over your legs. You can't duck under it. You can't walk through it. But it's just right for a big cat to move through it with no problem. So, you asked me, is it possible for a population of eastern mountain lion to live out here undetected? And I say yes, it's possible. As a species, they like to stay away from people. They don't go after garbage. And they're mostly nocturnal. But that doesn't mean that that's what I think is out there. More likely it's somebody's pet that was brought out here and let loose.
Roger Penniman mentioned another possibility.
Yeah, I know. We talked about it, and it would be nice to keep a thing like that out of the papers. There's been enough wild speculation going on around here as it is.
You don't put much stock in it?
All I know is I know the difference between an African lion and whatever this was. And I don't think it was an African lion.
But you're not sure?
I probably would have been if I had seen it longer. As I say, the headlights were bouncing around. And the animal, whatever it was moving like a stop. I mean, it was moving.
is it?
Miss Penniman, I'd like to speak with you.
Just a minute.
Miss Penniman, my name is Waverly Underhill.
I know. You're the guy Roger hired to take care of our pest problem.
May I come in?
I guess so. What did you want to see me about?
Well, for one thing, I was hoping you'd let me see the whale's tooth.
Sure, why not? Here, look at it all you want.
It's quite a remarkable piece.
I like it.
I take it, Nora, that you're not overly concerned about the so-called curse connected with this.
Really, Mr. Underhill, we're living in a nuclear age. Don't you think there are enough bad omens in the world already without our needing to invent more?
Even so, with a beast prowling around and you theoretically next in line, that ought to make you stop and think.
Sure it makes me stop and think. Sometimes I think I'm the only one around here who stops and thinks. I mean, this is just so stupid. So, what if some of my relatives died strange deaths? They all died differently. There's no pattern to it.
What about the beast?
Which I've never seen. And the only time I've heard it is late at night, when I'm half asleep. Oh, it's obviously somebody's pet that was let go when it got to be too much to handle. People are all the time driving out here and ditching their dogs and cats. Why not other animals?
You know, I was talking to your mother downstairs. She tells me you've been having dreams about it.
I had a dream about it. Why shouldn't I? It's all anybody talks about around here.
Would you mind telling me about it?
It was just a dream. That's all it was.
I'd still like to hear, if it's not too personal.
Oh, well, it was a couple of nights ago. I was asleep and I started having this dream. Sort of a nightmare, really. I was in a large room, like the inside of a barn. It had thick wooden beams overhead and light that filtered in through cracks in the walls. All I can remember is that all of a sudden I had this feeling that there was something up in the rafters. I couldn't actually see it, but I could hear it pacing back and forth on the beam right above my head. I knew that all I had to do was look up, and I would see whatever it was. But I couldn't lift my eyes. You know those dreams. You're trying to look at something, but you can't. Who knows? Maybe I was afraid to. Anyway, after a while, the dream shifted. And it was like I was sleepwalking out in the dunes. I was walking along a path that was worn down through the vegetation. And up ahead, I saw what I thought was a black rock lying in the middle of the path. Then I looked again, and I realized it wasn't a rock at all. It was a black panther buried up to its neck in the sand. It just stood there petrified. Slowly, it turned its head to look at me. Then it opened its mouth like it was going to scream. And it was like in a cartoon, where all of a sudden the mouth got really huge, and I could see all the way to the back of its throat. It screamed, or I did. I don't know which, but I woke myself up. Afterwards, I lay there trying to decide if I had actually heard something or was it all in my mind. Then I noticed one thing that must have been causing at least part of the dream.
Oh? What was that?
Roger. He was up on the roof pacing in his pajamas. Obviously, it was his pacing that I was hearing in my sleep and turning into an animal. So, now are you going to analyze my dream for me?
I'm afraid I'm not much good at that. You know, Nora, your mother and father are both very concerned about your safety.
Oh, that's a laugh. The only thing my stepmother is concerned about is controlling other people's lives. As for Roger, he's much more worried about his reputation on campus. You know, that's the real reason he hired you to clear this up. He's afraid the faculty will laugh at him.
Still, your parents are worried. They're concerned you're not taking this seriously enough.
I really don't believe this. Why is it when I act like an adult, everybody expects me to act like a juvenile? I'm not a child, Mr. Underhill. And I refuse to believe in some fairy tale curse just because everybody else is getting hysterical over it.
she has her doubts about the curse, but we'll find out more. Maybe she'll change her mind as we advance.
Bit of a, yep, definitely a teenager.
yeah, I know it all, teeny bopper.
Well, not only have we had our own, I remember being that kind of a teenager myself. Yeah. But it's like I always told my sons, it's what you learn after you know it all that really counts.
Yeah. That's where the real learning begins.
Yeah, absolutely.
As soon as you know it all.
Yep.
And as I always say at work, well, as soon as you know everything, they change stuff.
That's exactly it. Exactly.
They
yep.
change stuff. It's either a new technology or a new, who knows. And quite often new bosses. But that's a whole other story.
Yep, yep. But the story deepens. Wow. And yet, two more parts to go. So
two more. Where shall this go with the curse? Maybe she'll come around. This one's a lengthy piece, a little over 18 minutes. So grab yourself a snack while you turn up the volume so you don't miss nothing as we continue through the curse of the whale's tooth. His tooth.
Tooth. Tooth. Tooth.
Not a three.
It took us several false starts before we finally discovered the trail that led to the hunting shack where we hoped to find the young writer living alone in the woods. A high, thin fog that was slowly burning off made the woods seem darker and more dense as we passed through them, while each clearing that we came to was filled with a dazzling light as though sunlight was seeping in from every direction. We followed the path that was little more than a deer trail for several miles until we came upon one of these suffused openings, and there, suddenly, in the middle of the clearing, stood the hunting shack, staring back at us with its door widely ajar. Captain Underhill stopped us. We both stood listening for a moment.
Do you hear anything?
No, I don't. Should I?
I guess not. It's these damned ears of mine. At my age, I keep expecting them to go bad on me, but they never do.
Shouldn't we call out and let him know we're approaching?
No. No, I have the feeling he already knows. That is, if he's still around. It's possible he heard us coming and took off.
Why should he do that?
We'll find out. Let's go in.
I felt uncomfortable making such a secretive approach and entering the cabin without permission. Nevertheless, without saying anything, I followed behind and crossed the threshold right behind him. The fog was as thick inside the cabin as out. In one corner, I could make out a bunk with a sleeping bag unrolled on top of an old mattress. Lying under the bed was a knapsack and duffel bag. On a shelf above the window, I saw a row of books and a pair of binoculars. The other side of the room was the kitchen and dining area. An alcohol stove was set out on a fold-down bench. A solitary chair made of pieces of driftwood was drawn up to a wooden table. On the table was a hurricane lamp, the beginnings of a letter, with only a few sentences put down, and a half-finished cup of coffee. You were right, Waverly. He must have heard us coming and took off.
Oh, I don't think so, Alex. The coffee's cold, and there's a layer of pollen floating on top. Also, the kerosene lamp is burned dry, and the wick's charred. I'm afraid our inhabitant left some time ago. Obviously at night, or he wouldn't have had the lamp burning. And obviously, he intended to come back. The question is, why didn't he? I think we'd better have a closer look around.
We left the cabin and began a search of the immediate area. In back was an old windmill, still standing but no longer working. The top was just barely visible through the drifting fog. The blades of the wind vane hung limp and broken like damaged feathers. A crow sat above, eyeing us with more than the usual circumspection. Waverly noticed it the same time I did. There was something about this crow. Either it was especially tame, or there was something down below it was jealously guarding.
over here.
When we found him, he was lying partially concealed beneath a wild azalea bush, an expression of abject terror frozen upon his face, his mouth agape, his eyes rolled back. The wounds he had suffered began on either side of his face and continued downward in parallel lines that ended just below his diaphragm. The wounds were deep, and the flesh that had been flayed open was the prize the crow had been guarding so jealously. Despite all my years as a physician dealing with wounds of every kind, it still took me several minutes to gather my thoughts. Waverly, what are we going to do about this?
I'm afraid we have no choice. We'll have to report it to the police, though if I had my way, I'd prefer to keep quiet about it. You can imagine how it's going to compound the sensationalism already surrounding this case when news of this gets out. I must say this puts an entirely new complexion on things. It forces me to reevaluate my reasoning.
Captain Underhill's prediction about the publicity this would bring proved absolutely correct. Within a day after the discovery of the body was announced, the story made the evening news on all three networks. Reporters from every sector of the media converged on the area, filling every motel and hotel in the Lower Cape. A certain degree of hysteria naturally followed, but mostly the locals seemed willing to take the few extra precautions and let it go at that. Eventually, the story about the family curse resurfaced, and the Pennemans quickly became minor celebrities. They found themselves forced to hire a gatekeeper who was positioned day and night at the head of the drive to keep out the curious who were apt to drive down hoping to catch a glimpse of the beast. Within a week, however, with no new developments and no new sightings to report, the story began to taper off. Another hunt with hounds was authorized and carried out with no results. The event went through the usual stages of practical jokers calling up to report fresh sightings, probably by local merchants who hoped the boom in business would continue forever. Of course, there were the inevitable T-shirts. The worst one showed a row of claw marks down the front. On the back it read, "I got clawed on Cape Cod." While the story was playing itself out, Captain Underhill seemed content to spend most of his time either reading in a motel room or going out taking walks. I returned to my practice with the promise that he would call me if anything happened. 8 days after we found the body, I received a message at my office from Captain Underhill instructing me to meet him at the motel and bring a sleeping bag. I arrived several hours after dark. We set off walking almost immediately, leaving the lights of the motel behind and walking overland. We were soon enveloped by darkness. A wind that was beginning to stir was pulling sections of fog in off the ocean and sending them drifting through the pines like passing phantoms. Moving through the woods, you could feel them brush against your face, a ghostly touch. So palpable, it provoked unwilling goosebumps all over my flesh. Except for the sea breeze that made the faint whistling through the pine branches, and of course the ever-present distant foghorn of Highland Light, the night air seemed more quiet than it should have been. It was the quiet that got to me, magnifying my nerves and making it all the more difficult to follow behind Underhill, who had requested that I keep silent until we reached our destination, as he had neglected to mention where this was. And as we continued walking in what seemed a random direction, I began to think this destination might be some sort of mythical location. Whether we were lost or not, I made a mental note to myself never again to suggest that Underhill was in anything but perfect condition. Why are we stopping?
We're close enough.
To where?
To the house. Don't you see it? Over there. We don't want to get too close.
What are we going to do?
Wait. Wait and be patient. If we're lucky, we'll have a visitor.
You mean the creature?
There's a good chance. The Pennemans have heard it now 2 nights in a row. Always very late. Between 2 and 4 in the morning.
nocturnal predatory animals tend to be predictable in their hunting patterns. They follow the same circuit night after night.
What are you doing?
Getting into my sleeping bag. I suggest you do the same. We can expect a long wait, and we may as well be comfortable.
You're not zipping yourself in.
Why not?
What if it comes? How will you run? You'll be like one of those campers in Yellowstone who get trapped inside their sleeping bag and then mauled to death by the grizzlies.
And what chance do you think a man my age would have of outrunning it? If nothing more, this bag will provide some protection. If not from the beast, at least from the cold.
Well, I'm certainly not going to immobilize myself in some cocoon of a sleeping bag. I may lie down on it, but I'm not getting in.
All right. All right, suit yourself. But don't catch cold.
Waverly, you're not going to sleep.
Well, why not? We're going to be up late. A small rest now might do us some good.
It seems you're taking this whole thing far too lightly. You didn't even bring a gun.
No, but I noticed you did.
Yes, and I intend to use it if I have to.
All right. But keep in mind, if it's an eastern mountain lion that's out there, it's an endangered species. Killing it will mean a $20,000 fine.
Well, I'd rather pay the fine than pay for either one of our funerals.
Good night, Doctor.
Are you awake?
Yes.
I've been thinking about the gardener. There's something strange about him, don't you think?
Oh, I'd say so, yes.
What did you make of it?
I think people like that are their own worst enemy. Self-appointed spokesmen for God, they always manage a backward interpretation of everything they read in the Bible. And the Lord said, "Go forth, be fruit, fly, and multiple."
Yes. Well, all right. Go back to sleep. I'll take the first watch.
Yes, I knew you would. Good night, Doctor.
I hope you have nightmares. I heard something. What was that? Waverly, wake up. I think it's here. Waverly! Waverly, where are you? Waverly! Waverly!
Shh, be quiet. You'll wake the whole neighborhood.
Did you hear it? I'm sure I heard something.
Yes, I heard it. It's gone now.
Where were you?
Sitting about 10 yards away. Your snoring was making it too difficult to listen.
But did you hear it?
Yes, quite clearly. We can go now. I don't think it's likely to return.
Why not?
Because I've discovered our creature and the Cheshire Cat have at least one thing in common. The ability to appear and disappear at will.
Where the hell have you been? I tried reaching you all night.
Is something wrong?
Oh, no, nothing's wrong. Except last night that thing tried to kill Nora.
Was she hurt?
I thought we were hiring you to protect her. I don't know why we're paying to put you up at a motel if you're not going to be available when something
Where
like
that... Where is she now?
Upstairs, resting in her room. She's frightened.
She had a terrible scare, and
she still hasn't recovered. She wasn't prepared for this. Not at all. Anyway, my wife and I are making arrangements to move her off the property.
Suppose you tell me what happened.
I see you brought your doctor friend with you. Well, come with me. I'll show you. It happened out here, in the garage. The garage door was closed, of course. Nora came out through the connecting door that leads to the kitchen. We'd had an argument. She'd wanted to go out to go visiting friends. Priscilla and I were against it, but she promised to use extra precaution, and she did. Our agreement was, if she was going out at all, she would keep the windows rolled up and the doors locked and not get out of the car no matter what until she was safely out on the road and well away from the property. That's exactly what she did. Or tried to do. She came out here and got behind the wheel of the car. She turned on the headlights. She checked the doors and windows before leaning across to the glove compartment for the remote control switch that opens the garage door. As the door went up, she started the engine. Then she reached up to adjust the rearview mirror. That's when she saw it. It was standing there, illuminated in the red glow of the brake lights, standing in the open about 10 yards behind the car. The animal did not move, neither did Nora, who by now was completely frozen with fear. As she watched, the worst possible thing happened. It began to move. Not away, as any other wild animal would have done, but straight toward her. Deliberately and purposefully, it was going straight for the car. Priscilla and I were inside the house, expecting to hear the car back up and drive away. Oh, my God!
Roger! It's Nora! Quickly! Quickly!
I see. What time was this, approximately?
Around 8:30 or 9.
When you came out, did you or your wife see the animal?
No, of course not. The car horn frightened it off. What are you suggesting, that she made this up?
No.
Because if you are, you're completely wrong. I don't know what sort of opinion you have formed about my daughter, but I know she is not capable of putting on an act like this. Nora saw the thing. I've seen it twice. The park ranger saw it, and it has already killed a man. Are you suggesting all this is a figment of our imagination?
Oh, calm down, Mr. Penniman. Tell me what you intend to do about it.
Well, the first thing we're going to do is to get Nora away from here as fast as we can.
I'd rather you didn't.
And for what reason?
I'm afraid if she disappears, so will the creature.
Now, what would you like us to do? Use her as bait? Try to lure the creature back? Why not simply stake her down out in the yard? Maybe that's what you'd like us to do.
Professor Penniman, please. Captain Underhill is only
trying to... You know the last thing she said to me? Last night, before she finally went to sleep? She said she was giving it back. The whale's tooth. She doesn't want it anymore. She wants me to get rid of it.
Did you?
I will. I'm going to. This morning, as soon as she wakes up.
If you don't mind, Professor Penniman, when she does wake up, I'd like to go up and talk to her first.
I waited with Roger and Priscilla Penniman in their kitchen while Captain Underhill went up to talk to their daughter. I had seen enough of Captain Underhill's methods to know that he was working on a theory, and I sensed that he felt he was getting close to a solution. The interview did not last long, no more than 5 minutes. When he came back down, I could see that something had happened to change his mind. Underhill's explanation to the Pennemans was that he needed a little more time to work on the case, but that he was convinced the danger to Nora was past. He would not explain why, except that he recommended that Roger follow Nora's request and take back the whale's tooth. Later in the car, I asked him for more information about what occurred upstairs. He told me that Nora, in bed and obviously shaken, had given an account of the incident that matched what her father had said. He had asked to take another look at the whale's tooth. She let him go over and get it himself from her dresser drawer. The interview concluded by him telling her he thought she was making the right choice in giving it up. It wasn't worth the risk. She agreed. And that was the end of it. I hinted that I would like to know what theories he was working on. He told me he had one, but it had recently undergone a major reassessment. He refused to say more, except to tell me I might as well return to my practice. He would call me again when there were further developments. I heard nothing more from Underhill for more than a week. I kept an eye out for any new information that might appear in the paper, but the story had largely dropped out of sight. Magazines, of course, were still brimming with it, but only essentially rehashing what was already known. I read a blurb in the Cape Cod Times that a film company had concluded a financial agreement with the Pennemans to come and shoot footage and tape interviews for a television special.
Well, then, put it on TV. Might as well.
But yet, there's one more part left, right? One more part.
Yeah. That is not quite the end. There is one
that is not quite the end. There's
segment
more.
Remaining. And
more to
what and after that segment, Dave, you know what's going to happen, don't you?
Well, we're going to go back to the time before time and hear what the latest episode of Ugg the Caveman, the world's greatest inventor.
Ugg returns as the inventor of pretty damn near everything we use today. Underappreciated,
right?
Underreported inventor.
Well, you know, it's just so hard. You know, they didn't always put the storyboards on the cave walls and to get them from time to time and have to, you know, it takes time to make up all this well-thought-out information here.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to fill in the holes, and that's all I'm doing is filling in the holes.
Yeah, it's kind of like working with mortar. But Dave the bricklayer.
Kind of like that.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, it's a fun story. I like monster movies, but honestly, I like a good thriller like this too, where you know, you're not sure what's going on and who's doing what.
Yep.
And to whom.
Mm-hmm. And to whom? Yes. Yeah, it's not the who, but the whom. Yeah.
Yes.
I never have figured out the correct usage of who and whom myself, but.
Well, whom is a cartoon sound effect, I think. It's very much like an explosion.
Oh, is it? Okay.
I don't know. I made that.
Yeah, it kind of sounded that way. It did.
Yeah, I confess.
Yep.
I was full of flim-flammery or something. I don't know what you call it, but I call it good radio tonight.
Oh, yeah. So I told you it was a long one, but it's a good story. And yet, exciting conclusion lies ahead.
We might as well get to it. So we have plenty of time to visit with Ugg from the past. Here we go with the curse of the whale's tooth. Let's find out what happens. All
right. Okay. Great.
Goat. Cue goat.
All right. Mr. and Mrs. Penniman, if you'll both have a seat on the sofa, we'll take an exposure reading, and then we can begin the interview.
Thank you.
Do I look all right?
Yes, Mrs. Penniman, you look fine. Nora, I think if you don't mind, we'll have you sit this one out. We'll get to you a little later.
Fine by me.
Rick, control truck says they're picking up sound from the generator.
Are all the windows closed?
I could try closing the curtains, if that would help.
That's a good idea. Why don't we do that?
What are they doing outside?
You've never seen a fog machine? I'm afraid that's the way we do it in the movies. While these interviews are going on, a second crew is going to be filming outside shots of the house.
It's ironic. We almost always have fog around here, and yet on the one night you could use it.
Actually, it's good we don't. We'll be using a helicopter a little later for air-to-ground shots with a searchlight. Obviously, we need clear skies for that.
Maybe you'll be lucky and actually film the creature from the air.
We hope so, but no one's counting on it.
Rick, control says they're ready. They have sound and picture.
Okay, then. We can get started. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Penniman, as I've already explained to you, all we want is for each of you to tell us in your own words about some of the strange things that have been happening here the past few weeks. I'll ask you not to interrupt each other. You can take as much time as you want. All right. Let's begin with you, Professor Penniman.
Wait a minute, Rick. Control says wait a minute.
What is it?
We got a problem. Something's gone wrong.
What's going on here? Who is this person? What's he doing here?
I heard you were shooting a film. Thought you might need a few extras. This is my friend, Dr. Schofield.
What the hell is this? Captain Underhill, this is not the time for you.
Get out of here!
I brought some other volunteers. Federal agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The Coast Guard, too, if you need them. They're down at the beach.
Get out of here. You're ruining everything.
My advice to you, Nora, since you're about to be taken into custody, is not to say anything until your parents can arrange a lawyer. If you film people would like to step outside and introduce yourselves, they're waiting for you.
My God, Underhill, what is this?
Nora, what's he talking about?
Better let me explain. No point in Nora incriminating herself further.
You're saying Nora had something to do with this?
She had just about everything to do with it. Of course, she was not acting alone. My compliments, Nora, to whoever dreamed this up. An ingenious deception. Elaborate. And almost flawlessly executed.
Go get stuffed. Nora, shut up.
You're saying all of this was staged?
An illusion, Professor Penniman. Done for effect. Just as that fog machine outside creates the illusion of fog.
But why? For what purpose?
To carry out a large-scale drug smuggling operation. To bring drugs ashore. I'm afraid your daughter has at least that much in common with old Jacob Penniman. A propensity towards smuggling.
But I don't understand. How is it possible?
Well, shall we go back to the beginning? Not as far back as Jacob Penniman, but to the night you first saw the creature.
But I did see it. It couldn't have been an illusion.
It wasn't. What you saw was a fully grown eastern mountain lion fitted with an unusual collar. I had hoped to have it here this evening. At this moment, the police are conducting a search of Ranger Johnson's house, where I expect it will turn up.
He was in on this?
Oh, yes. Yes, he was essential. He provided the second eyewitness. Two were necessary, you see, to make the media and the public sit up and take notice. Of course, a park ranger's eyewitness testimony in matters like this carries a lot of weight.
You said some sort of collar?
That's right. I haven't seen it yet myself, but I think I can describe it for you. First of all, it contained a miniature homing device that allowed them to keep track of where the animal was at all times. Such items are commonly used in large game wildlife studies. Studies similar to those Ranger Johnson performed on wolves in Minnesota. The collar also contained an electronic instrument that allowed them to administer small electric shocks on either side of the neck. This was the steering mechanism. Crude, but it provided some degree of control over the movements of the animal. Last of all, but equally important, was a built-in tranquilizing dart that could be triggered by remote control to inject a drug directly into the vein of the neck. This, of course, gave them the ability to go and retrieve the animal anytime they wished. All of this electronic gadgetry was packaged inside a shaggy mane that transformed the animal's appearance into a facsimile of an African lion. That was what you saw crouching in the bushes that first night, and later running along the dunes in the moonlight. Wendell Johnson saw it, too, as he drove in. He could have made up a story. He was prepared to. But why bother when he could describe what he had seen and have it suit his purpose exactly? The fact that the animal was moving so fast when he saw it is attributable to the electric shocks that were tormenting the beast, driving it into a frenzy of panic as it desperately tried to escape from whatever was inflicting the pain. That is, until the next shock sent it off in a new direction. The shocks, of course, were also useful in eliciting the blood-curdling animal screams you heard that night.
But if the creature was real, as you say, then how could it suddenly vanish when the hounds had it cornered in the underbrush? I was there. How can you explain that?
Yes, it was a vanishing act, but one that had taken place hours before. The hounds followed the trail to the point where the tranquilizing dart had been injected. As the animal began to go down from the effects of the drug, its natural reaction was to make its way to cover. The last few yards, it must have staggered and dragged itself along over the ground, thus laying down a stronger scent, which the hounds interpreted as getting closer. Why did the beast vanish? It vanished because men had come hours earlier, hoisted the animal into a sling, and carried it away. From this point on, the legendary creature ceased to exist in the flesh, so to speak, and became purely a fabrication. But unfortunately, by then the accident had already taken place. You know the one I mean, don't you, Nora? The young, aspiring Thoreau, living in his cabin in the woods, who heard a noise that first night and went out to investigate, only to be struck down by an animal driven half insane by electric shocks. That was an accident. No one but Roger Penniman knew the young man was staying out there, and so no one knew he'd been killed until Dr. Schofield and I found the body several days later. That scared you, didn't it, Nora? In fact, it almost made you call the whole thing off. That was why, for a week, nothing more was heard from the creature. Then, of course, you realized it was too late to pull out. What was done was done. Besides, the death of the writer in the woods fit in perfectly with what they were trying to accomplish.
Which was?
A media sensation. A publicity hype. They set about resurrecting an old myth about a family curse, brought in a poor mountain lion to play the part of the phantom beast, and then watched as the press picked up the ball and ran with it. The result was an almost perfect smokescreen that would have allowed them to smuggle ashore millions of dollars worth of drugs in a single night under the pretense that they were shooting a film.
That seems like a lot of effort to go.
Not when you consider how much profit was at stake and the fact that this land is so ideally suited for the purpose. A private inholding inside a large public park with frontage on the ocean. The main difficulty was how to get all the trucks in and out without arousing suspicion.
When did you figure out all this?
I must say, for me, it's been a painfully slow process of realization. My mental faculties, like the rest of me, have gone considerably downhill in recent years.
Nonsense, Waverly.
Of course, from the beginning, I suspected that some calculating mind was behind this. It's not that I'm disposed to disbelieve stories about family curses, but I like to examine other possibilities first. I began with the strange appearance and disappearance of the beast. I decided to believe Professor Penniman's story that he had seen something in his backyard. And I was also inclined to believe the hounds, who do not usually lie about such things. If the beast had seemed to disappear when the hounds had it at bay, it seemed to me that there were only two ways this could have been accomplished. Either someone had dragged a scent like they do in fox hunts, or they had done the same thing with the animal itself. Because of the eyewitness accounts, I picked the second choice, which forced me to come up with a notion about the collar. I had concluded this much not long after my initial conversation with Roger Penniman, but I was still left with figuring out who was doing it and for what reason. At first, I suspected the writer in the woods, but that theory had to be discarded when we found his body. Then, of course, I turned my attention back to Nora, who I considered a likely candidate from the beginning. I suspected she was involved. Later, of course, I was certain of it when I heard the story about her close encounter with the creature while she was out sitting in the garage. By then, I knew very well the animal had not been around since the first night.
But wait a minute, Waverly. We heard it the night you and I slept out.
A recording, Doctor. A speaker system carefully hidden in the hollow of a tree. I went back the next day and found the wires. I apologize for not telling you, but I knew something was brewing and I didn't want to take a chance on anyone finding out. Anyway, I knew Nora was in on it, but I was having a devil of a time figuring out why. Her normal teenage rebelliousness and resentment toward her parents didn't justify her going to such lengths. Besides, there had to be others helping her, and the opportunity of embarrassing her father in front of the faculty did not seem sufficient to warrant all the effort. It is an example of how dim-witted I have become that it took until my second interview with Nora when I asked to see the scrimshaw once more and she pointed to the drawer where she kept it. I opened the drawer to take it out, and it was then that I noticed several small marijuana seeds stuck in the corner. Nothing particularly unusual about that in this day and age, but seeing them made me suddenly realize the angle I'd been overlooking all along, and literally in an instant, I knew exactly what they were doing it for. After that, there was nothing more to do but be patient and be ready when the time came. Aha, a helicopter. Could be theirs, but more likely it's the Coast Guard.
Captain Underhill, what's going to happen to Nora?
Smuggling is a serious crime, but it's also a crime that in this country we tend to treat somewhat lightly with respect to the punishments that are handed down. I suppose because in a peculiar way it represents an American ideal. Free enterprise in its most flagrant form. Unfortunately, there's also the murder to consider. Someone's going to have to answer for that.
Well, what do you mean? What murder?
The murder of the writer in the wood. Nora and her compatriots may try to claim involuntary manslaughter, but I think second-degree murder will be the one that sticks. Releasing a wild animal like that and then tormenting it with electric shocks is the sort of reckless behavior that no judge is going to overlook. Without the murder, I think the most she would have gotten is probation, considering her age and lack of criminal record. As it is, I think she may want to start looking into correspondence schools.
And so ended what has become Captain Waverly Underhill's most famous case. Famous because of notoriety. Not because it was any more or less ingenious than the solutions he had provided in other criminal investigations. Rarely has there been a crime whose intentional purpose was to create as much publicity as possible. It may be said that it reveals something about our national media obsession with human interest stories, that so many news organizations were so easily drawn in by the lure of a family curse and a predatory beast prowling the Cape. And then, at the height of all the attention, to have Captain Underhill step forward and expose it as a plot to conceal a smuggling operation. Well, it was simply a master stroke of genius, and all from a man who claims his mind is going. There's one final addendum to this narrative. It comes from an article written by a reporter who writes for a New England magazine. He did some checking into the ancestry of the young writer in the woods who was mauled to death by the lion. It appears the writer was distantly related to a woman named Esmalina Saffron, the same Esmalina Saffron who worked as Jacob Penniman's cleaning woman and who, following her association with him, bore him an illegitimate heir. The reporter naturally pointed out what a freakish coincidence it was that a direct descendant of Jacob Penniman should have met an untimely death in almost the same location and by the same manner in which Jacob Penniman was killed. I leave it to you to pass judgment, since it appears that a family curse, unlike the rest of us, is something not so easily laid to rest.
You have been listening to Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater's presentation of The Curse of the Whale's Tooth. Tonight's program was produced, written, and directed by Stephen Thomas Olney, co-produced by David Ellsworth, engineering by John Todd, sound effects by Scott Dickey, and with original music composed by Mark Birmingham. The actors in tonight's play, George McConville played Professor Roger Penniman. David Ellsworth was Captain Underhill. Wally O'Hara was Dr. Schofield. Lee Olive was Priscilla Penniman. Bob Gianferanti played the ship captain. Jeff Kamish was the first mate and the gardener. Neil McGarry was Wendell Johnson. Christy Weimar was Nora Penniman. Kevin Grumpy, the director. And Scott Dickey played the assistant to the director. Tonight's program was recorded at HT Recording Studio. This is Bob Nolan wishing you a pleasant evening and inviting you to tune in again when the fog rolls in on another chapter of Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater.
Pretty cool.
I like that story.
Kind of a somber ending there.
But tied it back to the very beginning as well. Yep.
Yes, it did. And did we learn anything? I don't know.
I learned a little something.
Did we?
Yeah. Ooh,
I'd have been more ready if I would have thought so. House Radio proudly presents A Garrulous Moral of the Story.
It's apologies to Gar. A curse is only a curse until the DEA shows up, and then it's left to the lawyers. There you go. Tarzan stamped his toe again.
Hey, it's almost time, too. Thanksgiving coming up.
It is almost time.
We got a Thanksgiving weekend coming up. We'll tell you more about that, though, a little later on. Don't we have a little visit from someone?
We do if we have his theme music here.
Of course. But now, ugh. That's it.
Being an inventor is quite a gift, but in the same breath, also a curse. There's so much pressure always to invent something every day, which wasn't really that difficult since almost everything, nothing had been invented yet. But one caveman who was up to the task was Ugg, the greatest inventor of all times. Actually, because they had so little to work with, everything a caveman did was an invention. They just didn't recognize that, and they just did that. They just invented something. It took someone like Ugg to not only see that he had invented something, but to find a use for that invention. But today's story isn't exactly about an invention that Ugg created, but what was created because of him. You see, every cave clan had an inventor, and in some cases, things were created almost simultaneously. And because the patent office hadn't been invented yet, no one really knew who invented what first. The problem, if this is a problem, is that Ugg's creations had been heard of throughout many, many cave peoples. So when they saw some new creation, they assumed that Ugg had made the discovery. Now, this upset many a cave inventor because they would not earn as many sparking stones if Ugg had invented it. One particular caveman, Glug, who was inventor of the Beelus Bog Clan, harbored resentment against Ugg for stealing his inventions and then taking credit. There was no cave paintings to prove that Ugg was taking his ideas, but that meant nothing to Glug. Glug left the Beelus Bog to exact his revenge on Ugg and eventually found himself at the Reflecting Pond. The long journey to the Reflecting Pond left Glug tired, sore, and very angry. And the fact that he forgot to bring along his woolly mammoth burger on his trip didn't help his mood either. Glug stared at his reflection in the pond and swore on everything that was holy, which back then was rocks and fire, that one day he would see Ugg pushed or drug into the pond and drowned, as Glug knew that Ugg could not swim. Actually, no caveman could swim because swimming lessons hadn't been invented yet, which is probably because the YMCA hadn't been invented yet. Anyway, as you can see, Ugg did not create the first curse, but was the recipient of it. It was Glug who invented the curse, but he was never able to enjoy his victory because the Reflecting Pond, only seeing Glug, got confused, reached out, and pulled him into the water. Glug had become a victim of his own curse. And as he went down under the water for the third and final time, he also invented the comic drowning technique that would be used starting with silent films all the way to today. So, as word of Ugg defeating the world's first curse spread, it only helped his fame grow. There was some talk from time to time around many a clan fire late at night that perhaps Ugg would travel to Egypt to break a pharaoh's curse by disturbing his tomb. But since the aliens hadn't helped the Egyptians build the pyramids yet, no trip was ever made.
Yet.
And although we do respect Ugg, the caveman, as the world's greatest inventor of all time, today we give Glug his due as inventor of the curse and the comic drowning. There you go.
There you go. Hey! Glug music.
Yeah, I always wondered until this time where the comic drowning actually came from, you know.
Just see, there you go. Ugg once.
Now we know through this vast research that I made up, we now know where the comic drowning came from.
Yep. And since we're talking about Ugg.
It's a magic little password. It'll help you if you're shy. Say, ugga-ugga-boo, ugga-boo-boo, ugga, ugga-ugga-boo, ugga-boo-boo, ugga. That will get you by. If you're in a conversation and you need a quick reply, say, ugga-go-boo, ugga-boo, ugga, ugga-go-boo, ugga-boo, ugga, that will get you by. Although the sound reminds you of a couple of lovey-dove birds, it's perfect when it finds you with your lips too busy for words. So be sure to keep it handy if the moon gets in your eye. Sing, ugga-go-boo, ugga-boo-boo, ugga, ugga-go-boo, ugga-boo-boo, ugga, that will get you by. Traffic cop should pinch you, and you end up in the jail. He will go your bail if a burglar ever robs you, and he grabs off all your jack. Say, he will give it back. Those words may sound peculiar when people don't know what they mean, but those words work like magic when you play a pinball machine. When you're flying in an airplane and the motor starts to thump, say, ugga-go-boo, ugga-boo-boo, ugga. Just before you jump,
there you go. You can't walk away from a Spike Jonze song feeling poorly.
You cannot. Yeah. It's like the banjo. You know, those are things, those sad banjo tuners. Those are things as a sad Spike Jonze song.
Yes.
Wow, that turkey better go into hiding.
Yeah, because next weekend we got some goodies for you, some Thanksgiving goodies. We're going to start with leftovers, I guess, because it'll be Friday, right? Burns and Allen, Lum and Abner, and the Jack Carson Show.
Hey.
Now that's Friday. That's Friday. On Saturday, it's going to be drama time with Family Theater, and also Let George Do It.
There you go.
So there. We would be very thankful if you join us.
Yep, and we did have somebody join us just this moment.
Yes, we did. Welcome. Welcome, C-Dubs.
Ugg.
A female ugg.
Female Ugg with Sister Knucklebuster's rock ruler, Ugg.
Greetings and felicitations. That was my great times 500 grandparent, a grandma.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah,
Ugg's bad half. Yeah.
So was that Ugg, any relation to Ugg way back then, or?
Oh, yeah, that was Ugg's better half.
Ugg
got boinked on the head with a rock. Yeah, Ugg, in and clean cave.
Often wondered who was the winner in that one, if the guy had to, you know, bonked a woman on the head, then, you know, she's, oh, I forgot how to cook. So, you know, he'd have to cook dinner, you know?
Yeah, that's never good. Yeah, he better watch so he doesn't get a bigger rock back on the head.
Oh, Ugg, go over there. Forgot to tell you. Great big chasm. Ugg, me go and get date with Ellie Oop now.
Ellie Oop?
Ah, yes.
There you go.
What a manipulator great-great-grandma was.
Yeah, boy.
So,
and then there's always
tofu turkey.
It's always the other caveman. I wonder if did Ugg ever meet the guy that used to sing "Gotta Find a Woman"? Gotta find a woman.
I don't know. You know, there's always research to make. Always research to make, Dale.
Yeah. Troglodyte. That was later, I guess. Yeah.
I don't know. Troglodyte. Oh, that was Trog. Yeah, and. I think, no, he and Ega never got along. He and Ega just didn't, no.
Ega and Trug.
No, just didn't click.
Joan Crawford did not like Trug.
No, didn't like Trug. But everybody liked Flintstone. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, I think they're direct descendants of Ugg after he invented everything.
Yeah, because, you know, they had all these modern conveniences, like the big big sedans where you started and stopped at your feet, you know?
Well, sure, and the dinosaur crane, you know, at the beginning.
Yeah.
Pterodactyl planes.
Oh, yeah. Dinosaur crane.
All thanks to Ugg.
Oh, yes, and the pterodactyl needle for your rock records.
Yeah, and also a bobbing one for your sewing machine. And a little pig for the garbage disposal.
Oh, there you go.
Totally forgot that one.
Yeah. And they were all sarcastic, too, the little buggers.
It's not well known, but
they were.
Mrs. Ugg created the recipe.
Yeah, all those appliances were a bit sarcastic.
Mrs. Ugg created the recipe for Bronto burgers.
Bronto ribs.
So big, like the computer. Kind of like the computer today when it freezes up on you and your computer decides to update in the middle of your work.
Oh, that's all right. I've had my entire system freeze on me right in the middle of the show, and I've had to reboot. While no one was looking. Not today. I've done that in the past.
Well, luckily we didn't lose anything. You know, I always wondered how that would go.
Yeah, and now we know that I can sign back in. When I sign back in, it goes, it looks like you're already here. We'll reconnect
you. There you go.
Doesn't say it quite like that, but it comes off like that.
Something to that effect, yes.
Yeah. So I hope that you guys have some good Thanksgiving plan. Our kids are coming over. Dave, don't you have an annual tradition?
We have our pardon the expression, we have our annual meatloaf. Yes, and so that is coming Thursday, meatloaf and mashed potato and corn and rolls. And then they have to roll me in the living room so I can watch the football games.
Yep. We're having the traditional We're having the traditional stuff. What are you having, CW, for your Thanksgiving fare? CW, what are you having for your Thanksgiving fare?
Yes, a medley of fresh. Oh, veggies, and tofu, and more tofu and veggies.
There you go. Not bad. Now, like, can you guys eat nuts and things like that? I love pistachios. And they're good. You know they actually lower your cholesterol as you eat them? That's true. All right. Think about that. We'll be back next week.
The castle lights are growing dim. There's no one left but me and him.
And her, we talked
when
about
next
that.
Next we meet in Frankenstone.
Yeah, hey, Vincent, we've spoken about this now.
Don't
I'm here.
Come alone.
You're usually a general.
Can
I don't
get... you dig it?
I don't get it.
Okay, let's dig it.
He's usually a gentleman.
Just for that, really, just for that, Vincent, you're cooking Thanksgiving dinner.
That's, ooh. I got a good picture of him with a knife hovering over a big, either a large chicken or a small turkey.
Ah, okay.
The demonic look.
Oh, wouldn't it have been great to have a meal cooked by Vincent Price if he had gotten invited over to his house or when he had that, he and his wife at the time had this beautifully tricked out RV and he was cooking there and had a...
I have one of his recipe books.
It was quite fashionable for the time.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Yeah, I have one of his recipe books, and I don't know that I have a palate
this
cultured enough to... I don't know that I have a palate cultured enough to appreciate his cooking. Some of his meals sounded a little, like, much for me from his cookbook. I have an uneducated palate.
Looking for his bougie.
Yeah.
Mm.
Where's the pizza in this thing here, Come on, where's the pizza?
Where's a nice PB&J?
Well, now I would be polite and try it. I mean, I'd probably end up liking it because the guy was good at everything else he did. Why not cook? You know, very cultured, and of course, cooking.
No kidding.
Was in his family.
If I can see him cooking, putting a spin on. Yeah. I can see him cooking something with a spin on Julia Child's famous beef bourguignon. Bon appetit. And this is Vincent Price's spin on it.
That'd be
extra
cool.
Red wine to make it really bloody.
There you go. That would be funny. They should have done it while they were both alive.
Oh, yeah, but the best... I know they should have. The best part of the meal would be just listening to him and being such a raconteur, just telling all the things he did, stage plays, movies, behind-the-scenes stuff and whatnot. I mean, I'd be too wrapped in listening to eat anything, or I'd eat meat before I realized I just ate meat. Oh, gosh.
Would you feel very poorly if you did? About it, I mean? If you ate meat accidentally?
Yes. Yeah, poorly philosophically and physically, because it's been way too long. So
yeah.
I will be excusing myself. Excuse me. I just need to get the Pepto for a minute or five. And,
Uh-oh, your mic's breaking up.
But please keep talking. Keep talking.
There you go. It's back.
Uh-oh.
It's back.
Uh-oh.
Yes.
Uh-oh.
You're back.
Oh, thank you. I'm back.
Here's almost a moral from Gar.
Oh, yeah?
I faded out again.
Yeah. I'm on his Twitch right now, and there's a description under it.
Here.
It wasn't the fall that hurt. Credited to H. Dumpty.
Well, guys, I just wanted to chime in quickly to say hello. Always listening. If I can't be there,
we figure you were cursed
in spirit, so to speak. I'm always there.
Yeah, we figure you were cursed with work this weekend.
I am a four-letter word.
Yep.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
See, you cursed on our show. Good work.
Yep.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I thought it was appropriate. Appropriate. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But if you wish, I'll be happy to conclude the evening with my final task of the night.
Boy, as you say. Lead the way, Columbus.
Oh, very good. Mr. Durante, come out here and tickle those ivories.
Good night. Good night. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Get that thing.
What more does this take but good night? Billy Day! We've had a few laughs.
Why have you stopped it?
And it's time for toodaloo.
What's that? What?
Sorry, Bull, up we the day.
We were worried about you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
All right.
Nighty, nighty.
Good night, folks. And good night. Mrs. Calabash, wherever.
Oh, she's a state of Augustine, Florida.
Calabash,
right.
Wherever you are. Oh, yeah. Oh,
the
Mrs. Calabash.
The foregoing has
she
made it obvious to me
that
we've had quite enough for one evening. We shall save the rest until next week when I shall reappear. Until then, good night.